Thank you so much to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. I haven't yet had the chance to visit Perimeter in person, but I hope that there will be an occasion to do so soon. So the subject of my talk is fractons. And as I said, my abstract, fractons are sort of new kinds of quasi-particles, which have been attracting the attention of physicists from a variety of backgrounds. My own background and perspective is that of a high energy theorist, but I'll try today to be broad and give you some motivations from quantum information theory and condensed matter physics as well. So somehow, like the structure of this talk will be that instead of having an extended introduction and then technical details afterwards, I'll sort of cycle between motivation and results repeatedly. But first, I should give you a sort of preliminary definition of what a fracton is. This field, I think it's safe to say, is still very much in its infancy, and so there isn't quite an all-encompassing definition available yet of what constitutes the theory of fractons. But in lieu of that, let me just offer like a few properties that practitioners might look out for. I'll be a bit hand-wavy for now, but we'll sort of do better as we go. And in particular, we'll see some of these properties come to life in examples. So for the purposes of what I want to tell you today, a fracton theory will be typically a quantum lattice model or maybe an exotic quantum field theory, which enjoys any of the following related properties. They're somehow not the most general kinds of properties that someone interested in fractons would consider, but they'll be the ones that I focus on today. So the first is that the theory might have particle-like excitations, which have limited mobility. For example, it might have planons, which are only allowed to move along distinguished two-dimensional planes in space. It might have fractons, which are forbidden from moving at all, and so on and so forth. A second property that it might enjoy is that it might have subsystem symmetries. And so these are symmetries which, unlike usual symmetries, zero-form symmetries, which typically act on all of space, so these can transform degrees of freedom along submanifolds. This property is often related to the previous one because, for example, if an excitation is charged with respect to a subsystem symmetry, then it sort of can't leave the submanifold that the symmetry is supported on without violating the conservation of that charge. And finally, they'll often have ground state degeneracy, which somehow grows subextensively with the system size, which is kind of an unusual ground state degeneracy. And again, this can be related to the previous item in this list because often this ground state degeneracy arises because you've sort of spontaneously broken subsystem symmetry, which has a subextensive number of generators or something like this. Okay, and so why do people care about fractons? One motivation for studying such systems, which is actually I think historically the first, is that they provide a promising starting point for tackling the problem of self-correcting quantum information storage. So I'm sure I don't need to remind this audience, but the basic problem is that quantum information is very delicate. Interactions with the environment can cause the state that you very carefully tried to prepare in your quantum computer to decohere. And so you want to encode information in a system which is sort of passively resilient to accumulating errors. So let me remind you of an older framework for fault-tolerant quantum computation and explain why it's not a solution to the problem of self-correcting quantum information storage. So an old proposal which goes back to Kataev is to consider a gapped quantum lattice model with a degenerate ground space, such that the ground states are all sort of locally indistinguishable from one another. And the idea is that you want to encode your quantum information in this ground space, and the rest of the Hilbert space sort of serves as a source of redundancy to protect your information from irreversible corruption. And the reason that this local indistinguishability condition is important is because, you know, by some theorem of quantum information theory, it essentially tells you that any sufficiently local error can then be corrected. So errors in this picture occur when you're taken out of the ground space. And if your system is, say, like a 2+1D model with a topological order, then you can often physically interpret an error as the presence of some kind of anionic quasi-particle excitation in your system. And so somehow the statement is that if a pair of anions is created and they don't travel too far across the length of the system, then you can detect them and re-annihilate them and recover the original state that you encoded. Conversely, if you actually want to manipulate your state for the purposes of performing computation, then you somehow wrap them around some kind of non-trivial cycle of the system and then re-annihilate them. And this implements a gate. So the sort of classic example of a model which achieves this, which we'll make use of throughout the rest of this talk, is the toric code. It's defined as the sum of these two terms, one associated to vertices, one associated to plaquettes, and I've drawn them on the right here. Because all of the terms commute with one another, you can compute all the ground state wave functions explicitly. On the torus, you find that there are four ground states, and you can just like explicitly verify that they satisfy this local indistinguishability condition. As far as excited state goes, there are sort of these open string operators, which you can act on vacuum states with. And the statement is that they produce excitations at their endpoint. Somehow you should interpret, say, this red string operator, whose endpoints are at vertices, as producing a violation of these vertex terms. So it flips their eigenvalues from +1, like it is on the ground state, to -1. And wrapping these string operators around a cycle of the torus produces a quantum gate. So there are a few limitations of the toric code. One that's not very serious at all is that the gates that you get in this way by wrapping anions are not sufficiently general that you can perform arbitrary quantum computation. But of course, the toric code isn't the only 2+1D model with topological order. There are, for example, an infinite family of models associated to arbitrary finite groups. And these form quantum error correcting codes. And for suitable choices of G, you can get a universal gate set. And to our surprise, these models actually hadn't been proven to be quantum error correcting codes. So I'll just point out some recent work where we filled in this small gap in the literature. But a bigger drawback is that the toric code is not the self-correcting quantum memory. So the issue is that if you sort of couple the toric code, say, to a heat bath or something like that, to simulate interactions with a noisy environment, then errors sort of accumulate rapidly enough that you have to actively, constantly be monitoring for errors and correcting them as they arise. Otherwise, they very quickly sort of proliferate and dominate the entire system and eventually corrupt your state. But what you really want is to be able to, go to lunch and come back and be able to apply one sort of recovery protocol and get your state back without having to continuously monitor it the entire time. And before the advent of fractons, the only systems that were known with the self-correction property were actually in 4+1 space-time dimensions, which is obviously prohibitive for implementation in the real world. So Ha, by a computer search, actually discovered this this 3+1D model, which is now called Ha's qubit code. It's also one of these commuting projector models built out of these two commuting projectors that I've drawn here. And so you can again solve it explicitly. And one of its main claims to fame is that this time, instead of like in the toric code where excitations are at the end of string operators, in this Hawes qubit code, the excitations are at the corners of these sort of fractal operators. And so what you can see from this is that, you know, say I create four excitations via a fractal operator, and I try to move one of them by applying local operators sort of in the vicinity in a small neighborhood of this fracton. Well, any local operator that I apply will sort of produce more fractons. The only way I can sort of move a fracton around is if I elongate this entire Sierpinski tetrahedron-like structure. And so that requires a very non-local number of operators. And so somehow the point is that any local manipulations that you try to apply are create fractons in the process, and creating fractons requires energy. So you should think that the movement of these fractons is somehow energetically suppressed. And so for the purposes of quantum self-correcting quantum memory, the significance is that the errors sort of stay localized as opposed to wandering the system. And if they stay localized, you should think somehow that you can actually correct them. So this is sort of the mechanism by which immobile particles solves this problem of self-correcting quantum memory. So another motivation is that, well, it's sort of one of, fractons is sort of one of the relatively rare instances in which thinking about applications presaged results of maybe a more fundamental nature. For example, one grand question of condensed matter physics is to try to classify all possible low energy phases of gapped local quantum lattice models. In 2+1D, the story is thought to be under pretty good control thanks to developments in the physics of topological phases and the related mathematics of tensor categories. But evidently, if one would like to understand the answer to this question in 3+1D, for example, then one has to confront fracton models. And so in relation to that, I emphasize that even though one's temptation might be to ride these models off as being in some sense extremely fine-tuned, I'll just say that many of the features which characterize the low energy physics, like ground state degeneracy, are often robust to arbitrary perturbations by local operators. So in those situations, you should think somehow there's like truly a whole open neighborhood in parameter space which exhibits fractonic behavior. So one kind of old and powerful idea for organizing phases of matter and phase transitions between them involves thinking about patterns of symmetry breaking as measured by order parameters. For a while, a lot of condensed matter research was marketed as exploring situations in which the so-called Landau paradigm apparently breaks down. In other words, they were studying phases like topological phases that apparently don't break any symmetries. But in fact, recently we've been appreciating that a lot of phases that were previously thought not to be accommodated by Landau's theory, like the Torah code, they in fact do admit a neat Landau characterization, provided one suitably generalizes what one means by the words symmetry and order parameters. As far as fractons go so far, I think it's fair to say that the focus has mostly been on sort of special exactly soluble models as opposed to entire phase diagrams. And when phase transitions are studied, for some reason, symmetry is rarely explicitly described. So some of my interest in the subject on the condensed matter end of things has been to try and flesh out in slightly more detail, mainly through examples that we think are representative, how this sort of Landau paradigm looks for fracton theories. But before we get there, let me just remind you of one sort of basic and useful kind of generalized symmetry, which is the notion of a higher form symmetry. So, so what's the definition? The definition is that, a theory with d plus one spacetime dimensions is said to have a Q-form symmetry. which we will typically denote GQ, if it admits operators supported on D minus Q dimensional manifolds, which their main property is that they should be topological in the sense that correlation functions should be insensitive to deformations of the manifold, so long as one doesn't deform through a charged operator. And of course, they should sort of furnish a representation of the group as well. Since I'm going to be, for the most part in this talk, working on the lattice, I'll essentially always be taking space-time to factorize into time times a spatial manifold. And I'll be mainly focusing on situations in which this manifold is defined at a fixed instant of time. And so in that case, the operator sort of manifests as a unitary, which actually acts on the Hilbert space. And I'll just say for anyone that's new to this subject, higher form symmetries at first might seem sort of exotic, but somehow like the most basic examples of field theories have them, like free electromagnetism, for example, has one form symmetries in 3 plus 1D. So let me explain why one form symmetries are useful for the Landau paradigm. So one sort of classic example, I think maybe even the first example of a phase transition thought to be beyond the Landau paradigm, was Z2 lattice gauge theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So here you put qubits on the edges, and the Hamiltonian is essentially what I've written here. It's the sum of this single body X term plus this Plaquette Z term. And then you have some kind of Gauss's law constraint. The details don't typically matter. Somehow, the main point is that this theory has a one-form symmetry, and it's implemented by operators that are supported on paths through the dual lattice. So I've drawn that operator here. And you should think that the operators that are charged with respect to the symmetry are also line operators. And here it's some kind of analog of a Wilson loop. It's called the Wegener-Wilson loop. And the statement is that as you vary this coupling G from small to large, the theory undergoes a phase transition. It goes from a trivial phase when G is very small to a sort of deconfined one-form symmetry breaking phase when G is very large. And you can measure this phase transition by studying the vacuum expectation value of this Wilson loop, if you'd like. And it switches from having an area law to a perimeter law. So by generalizing from ordinary zero-form symmetries to one-form symmetries, somehow you capture a lot of phases, like topological phases, within the Landau paradigm. So now I should tell you about another class of global symmetries, which is useful in fracton physics, and these are these like foliated zero-form subsystem symmetries. So as part of the input data, you typically specify a foliation of space by leaves of codimension K, let's say. And since we're on the lattice, we'll just think of these leaves as being sort of sublattices of dimension D minus K. And just as a comment on notation, I'll be using symbols like F parallel XY to denote the kind of obvious foliations of a lattice by say planes that are parallel to the XY directions. Okay, so again, focusing on operators at a fixed instant in time, you say that a theory has a foliated zero form subsystem symmetry of codimension K if for each leaf of the foliation, there's some operator supported on that leaf, which commutes with the Hamiltonian. And the reason that I've done this
correction. Right. I have a very quick question, Brendan, just to make sure I understand. So all these theories for K bigger than zero would be kind of topological theories, right? They don't have local operators and local correlation functions, or do they?
No, they can have. They can for sure have local operators and local correlation functions. Why do you say that they shouldn't?
I thought it would be too drastic to impose that you can put really a surface that you can move and it doesn't matter where it is. I thought this would imply that the correlation functions, I'm not saying you cannot put, I'm saying you that they will be topological or not.
Oh, good. So these the operators on different leaves are, you shouldn't think that like I can move from one leaf to another. It's not topological in that sense. Somehow the operators that act on different leaves are independent from one another. So it's different from a higher form symmetry. Higher form symmetries are topological, and so I think the intuition you gave applies there. But for these subsystem symmetries, you should think they're rigid operators. So the operator applied at one leaf is different from the operator applied at a different leaf.
My mind, I was reading this as a generalized symmetry. So this is something new now that you are introducing, foliated subsystem symmetry.
Yes, this is a new kind of symmetry that's been talked about in the context of fracton theories, yes. In a moment, I'll actually combine higher form symmetries with subsystem symmetries, but maybe...
Previous lattice model was a topological model or not? Zito gauge theory.
Indeed, yeah. This is just an ordinary one-form symmetry. So this x operator, this x string operator is topological. So if you move it around on the ground state, if you deform it, its action doesn't change.
Sure, sounds good. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this quotient, so the reason is, okay, so one feature of these subsystem symmetries is that in general, they might have relations that are satisfied between symmetry operators that are supported on leaves of different foliations. And I'll be a little bit more specific about what these relations look like in a second, but if there are no relations, we refer to the symmetry as sort of being relation-free. So, in order to describe these relations, it's useful to define a sort of privileged class of subgroups of foliated subsystem symmetries. And these subgroups are defined by making use of this notion of a coarsening of a foliation. So you say that a foliation of some smaller codimension is a coarsening of a foliation of a larger codimension if somehow each leaf of F sits inside some leaf of FC. And furthermore, somehow you want that the leaves of F also foliate the leaves of FC. So if that was too abstract, you can just look down here for a picture. So here I have, you know, two different foliations. One is by lines pointing the X direction. One is by lines pointing in the Z direction. And they both sort of can be coarsened to this foliation by planes. You know, somehow you should think this plane is foliated by these blue lines and also by these red lines. And so, both of these foliations coarsen to the same foliation here.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Huh?
Can I ask a question? Is there an example of the subsistence symmetries that we are familiar with, like equivalent for the higher form symmetries of free electromagnetism?
It depends on whether you've been following this fracton stuff, but basically, like, you should imagine you would not ever expect like a relativistic theory, for example, to have a subsystem symmetry, because somehow you're like privileging certain directions in space. So if you're used to working in the context of relativistic theories, for example, like there's almost no chance you've encountered a kind of subsystem symmetry out in the wild. But I'll give an example of a lattice model in a moment that has subsystem symmetries.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So somehow whenever you have whenever you can coarsen a foliation, then this gives rise to sort of a distinguished subgroup. So maybe instead of explaining this abstract definition, I'll just say that, like, you know, say you have some model where you can do spin flips along lines. So that would be called like a linear subsystem symmetry, let's say. That will always admit a planar subgroup. So a subgroup which acts on planes. And the reason is, so this plane operator here would be defined as like the product of all the lines that live inside of it. So somehow you flip the spins on each of these vertical lines and each of the horizontal lines in the plane, and that defines this plane operator. So you can often, yeah, so the punchline is that you can often look for subgroups of your subsystem symmetry groups that have a lower codimension. Okay, so here's an example of a very simple lattice model, which enjoys a linear subsystem symmetry. It's called the cubic Ising model, and it's sort of the sum of just you put qubits on the vertices, and the Hamiltonian is just obtained as a sum of a single body X term and this like eight body Z term. These eight Zs are sort of at the corners of cubes in the lattice. And so you can convince yourself that in this model, you can do spin flips along any 1D lattice that points parallel to the X, Y, or Z directions. So, and the reason basically is that, you know, for example, this operator always, it always commutes with this first term, and it always commutes with the second term because it always overlaps with it in an even number of places. And, you know, poly X and poly Z anti-commute with one another. So if they overlap in an even number of places, then those two negative signs essentially cancel. But this symmetry has certain relations. And to describe them, I'll just say that like these planars, this planar subgroup that I defined on this previous slide acts trivially in this model. And the reason is sort of a silly reason, but nonetheless, the fact that the relations are there is going to be important. The reason is just that, say, you know, you define this XY plane operator. It's a product of the Y lines and the product of the X lines. Now, this
a question, because now I'm confused about something very basic about this higher symmetry. What's the simplest theory which has higher symmetry and is not free?
The simplest theory that has a higher form symmetry and isn't free? Yang-Mills theory has it. Has a Zn center symmetry, which is like a one-form symmetry. What else could I tell you?
Okay, thank you.
That would be the simplest one, I think. Okay. So anyway, so I guess maybe the punchline of the slide is that the global symmetries of this theory are sort of can be described as like a linear subsystem symmetry, but where you quotient out by some kind of planar subgroup, because these plane operators all act trivially in this model. I can, just to convince you that this model is like exhibits some of the features of fractons that I was discussing previously. Here, let's say you take G to be very large, and so you can essentially neglect this first term, and you want to look for excitations of this model. The excitations are essentially violations of this cube term. So, when you turn off this term, it becomes a commuting projector model. And so you can essentially solve it by demanding that all these cube terms have eigenvalue one. And you interpret when one of the cube terms has eigenvalue minus one as there being an excitation supported on that cube. And the way that you can create excitations from the vacuum is by acting with this like cuboid operator, which I've drawn here. So you just take a product of poly X's over some cuboid. And the statement is that produces excitations at its sort of corners, these red corners. And the reason that these are immobile is because, say you want to move them, well, you have to just increase the size of this entire cube. And that there's no way you can increase the size of this cube just by acting with, operators that are in the vicinity of one of these fractons. You have to sort of apply operators in a very non-local region. But on the other hand, if you sort of collapse this cube into a line, and sort of, you know, four fractons form a bound state, then you can actually just apply like local operations and move this sort of quadruple of fractons in one direction. So a common feature that you'll see with these models is that sometimes, even though in isolation a fracton is immobile, you can occasionally form bound states which have some level of mobility. Okay, so one notion that, it was difficult for me to figure out how obvious or not this was to experts, but, you know, I've never seen this string of words in the literature anywhere. And yet it's a totally natural notion of symmetry, and it sort of is working underneath the hood in a lot of examples. So maybe I won't say that we introduced it, but I'll maybe just say that we emphasized it in recent work. This notion of a higher form subsystem symmetry. So if you'd like, it's some kind of combination of the two previous notions that I've been advertising. And so the intuition is that, you know, a theory has a higher form subsystem symmetry, basically if it has an ordinary higher form symmetry within each leaf of its foliations. Maybe I don't know how useful it'll be for me to give this definition, but somewhat more precisely, you say that a theory has a symmetry group G, Q, K, F1, F2, dot, dot, dot. If somehow for each leaf and for each submanifold inside of the leaf, there are symmetry operators supported on that submanifold, which are topological in the sense that you can deform the submanifold within the leaf to which it belongs. So you should imagine there's like these leaves which foliate space, and you can define like operators inside of those leaves, and you can deform them around, and correlation functions are insensitive to those deformations, but you're only allowed to deform these operators within the leaf to which they belong. And that's basically a higher form subsystem symmetry. And I'll just emphasize that there's a way to define relations here too. And so like one, maybe just to give one example, say you have a planar one-form subsystem symmetry. Unpacking that, what that means is that somehow within each plane of your theory, you have topological string operators. So somehow within each leaf, you have these strings that you can deform at will. And one natural subgroup that you can define is just an ordinary one-form subgroup of that symmetry structure. And okay, so in order to define a one-form group in 3+1 dimensions, I have to define for you some membrane operators. And the statement is that those membrane operators are sort of defined by sort of, you build up this sphere, for example, by taking products of circles that foliate it. So I have these line operators are part of the definition of a planar one-form symmetry. So I have those, and I can sort of build up a sphere by taking products of these, over the z-axis and building up the sphere that way. Okay, maybe I should pause for questions here. Okay, I worry that I've irreparably confused people. Okay, so maybe I won't go into too many details about this, other than to say, you know, there's this paradigmatic example of a fracton model, which is called the X cube model. And somehow you should think it has precisely this kind of symmetry structure, in the sense that, you know, within each plane, you can define these string operators, but they're precisely subject to this relation that I described on the previous page, that if you sort of foliate these strings into membranes, then those membranes necessarily act trivially. So if you'd like, the symmetry structure of the X cube model is like this planar one-form subsystem symmetry, modulo this relation, which says that membranes act trivially. And membrane operators are just symmetry operators of an ordinary one-form symmetry in 3 plus 1D. I'll skip this. Okay. So maybe let me turn to one kind of application of these symmetries. So it's been known for a few years now that many foliated fracton models can be obtained by a couple layer constructions. So in these constructions, you sort of take stacks of lower dimensional theories and you couple the leaves of these stacks together in some way. And it turns out that you can get a non-trivial fracton order like this. And so part of our work was to revisit some of these constructions equipped with these principles of higher form subsystem symmetries in mind. And at least for me, I found that thinking about symmetries revealed some additional structure and logic which underlies these constructions. And in particular, it led to new examples, which I hope to summarize briefly for you. So let me start by reviewing what I think was essentially the first couple layer construction of a fracton model, namely the X cube model. So the starting point of the construction involves considering three decoupled stacks of Torah code layers. So essentially, you know, a picture like this, but in addition to stacks going in this direction, you have stacks going the other two directions as well. Okay, so if you think of these three decoupled stacks as a genuinely 3 plus 1D model defined on a cubic lattice, then the Hilbert space essentially consists of two qubits per edge because each edge belongs, you should think, to like two Torah code planes. And so in this construction, one couples together the various leaves by on each edge sort of adding this two-body X operator. So there's two qubits per edge and you couple them together with this two-body X term. And the claim is that when you take this coupling to be very large and you compute the low energy effective Hamiltonian in this strong coupling regime, then you get precisely the X cube model. And somehow at intermediate values of Kx, as it's taken from small to large, there should be some kind of phase transition, which takes you from this decoupled layer phase to an X cube phase. And so these authors had some words about what mediates this phase transition. They use the words p-string condensation, which I won't talk about today, but the question I want to try and answer today is like, is this transition a Landau transition? And the answer is yes. And the mechanism is actually fairly straightforward. So remember, the first example of a model I gave you was that, you know, this Z2 gauge theory, basically the same thing as Torah code, has a one-form symmetry. And here we've sort of foliated space with these Z2 gauge theory layers. And so you should think that that produces a model with like a trivial planar one-form subsystem symmetry group. And crucially, you know, when the layers are decoupled, this symmetry is relation free, just because, you know, there's nothing that tells me that there should be any kind of relation between the different stacks when they're not coupled to one another. So another way of saying this is that small kx, this entire symmetry is spontaneously broken. But at strong kx, we just made the claim that the low energy Hilbert space coincides with the low energy Hilbert space of the X cube model. And so I tried to summarize how in the X cube model, you don't have quite a one form planar subsystem symmetry, but rather you have that structure, but with this quotient, this relation imposed where membranes act trivially. So if these membranes act trivially on the ground space, then another way of saying that is that this one form symmetry group becomes unbroken at large coupling. So somehow you should think that this phase transition from a decoupled layer phase to this X cube phase driven by this this coupling Kx here precisely coincides with a spontaneous symmetry breaking phase transition. And the symmetry that's actually unbreaking in this case, I guess, is this one form symmetry, which is generated by these membrane operators that I drew here. So this suggests a sort of general mechanism. Say you're interested in some target model, which has some kind of higher form subsystem symmetry group, but it enjoys some kind of relation described by some subgroup H. The first step involves approximating this symmetry structure by placing sort of a D minus K dimensional theory with an ordinary Q form symmetry on each of the leaves of the foliations that are involved in this symmetry structure. That yields a version of this symmetry, but there's no reason for this relation H to be satisfied in this decoupled layer model. And so the solution is that you sort of strongly couple these leaves together with a term which drives the Landau transition from a phase in which H is unbroken, as in this decoupled system, a phase in which H is broken, like in this decoupled system, to a phase in which it is unbroken. And because H becomes unbroken in this new phase, somehow you should think the low energy, it acts trivially on the low energy Hilbert space. And so from the point of view of the low energy effective Hamiltonian, it looks like H is being imposed as a relation. And so typically the phase of this model in this strong coupling regime will coincide with the target model that you're interested in. And maybe I was gonna show an example of this. I gave the cubic Ising model. I was gonna show that this general paradigm leads to new examples. For example, you can get a coupled wire construction this way of the cubic Ising model. And it turns out the wires you can use are just transverse field Ising models, and you can sort of drive a spontaneous symmetry unbreaking transition where that imposes relations on these wires. But maybe let me not describe that. Okay. Let me briefly describe in words one other mechanism for getting non-trivial fracton theories from decoupled layers. And okay, the mechanism is as follows. So I've been trying to highlight that the sort of difference between a decoupled layer system and like decoupled torque code layers and a non-trivial fracton system like the XQ model is precisely the fact that the XQ model has certain relations in its symmetries that are not satisfied by the decoupled layer system. And so one sort of very naive way that you could imagine imposing these relations by fiat is simply just by gauging the subgroup. So when you gauge a global symmetry group, it ceases to become a global symmetry of the gauged theory. And so you might think you've won, you've sort of trivialized its action by construction, and so victory. But one thing that you have to be careful about is that somehow the gauged theory itself grows its own emergent global symmetry. So this turns out not to be an issue, essentially because, well, let me try and say it this way. So start with your decoupled layer system and consider the phase transition that it enjoys when each of the layers individually undergoes a spontaneous breaking of its one-form symmetry. So after you gauge, I've told you how you sort of get some of the symmetry that you started with modulo the relation, but you also grow a symmetry. So it turns out that in the case that you're in this phase where the symmetry of the ungauged model is broken, then this new symmetry that you grow turns out to be unbroken. And conversely, if you're in this phase where the symmetry of your ungauged model is unbroken, then the symmetry that you grew turns out to be broken. So somehow if we stay over here in the phase diagram at where you're in the symmetry broken phase of the decoupled layer model, then you have precisely the symmetry structure that you want. The emergent symmetry that the gauged model grew that you thought was going to mess you up sort of is unbroken, and so it doesn't really appear in the low energy physics. But on the other hand, this this higher form subsystem symmetry modulo the relations sort of remains. And so you can convince yourself that this construction goes through nicely. Okay, I want to maybe move on to the high energy portion of my talk, because I think I'm running out of time. But maybe I should pause for questions.
So in your example, before you gauge in your example of X-cube models, what is the order parameter that detect the phase transition in the X-cube model?
Good. So you mean, so which phase transition are you wondering about? Do you mean?
Phase transition driven by the coupling between different layers of toroid.
I see. Good. So let's see. So because it's a one form transition, it should be measured by some kind of line operator. I'm trying to remember which line operator does the job. We certainly wrote this down in our paper. I think in that case, you know, each of these let me just say I'll have to double check, but I think in that case, you know, each of these toric code layers has this Wegener-Wilson loop, and so somehow any one of those should probably be fine. But let me actually double check and get back to you.
So some operator that is charged under that membrane operator, is that right statement?
Yeah, exactly. Indeed.
But not with other one form symmetry.
Hopefully not with the, well, actually the other, you know, the rest of the planar one form subsystem symmetry is sort of just broken throughout the entire phase transition. So it's probably okay if you're also accidentally charged with respect to that. But the main thing is that you want something that's like charged with respect to this membrane operator. And unfortunately I'm forgetting exactly which operator does the trick, but maybe I can email you after this.
And another question is, do you know how to construct the effective theory at the critical point from your picture?
Good. Here you're again asking about the transition from decoupled toric layers to the X-cube model.
Yeah, for example.
Yeah, so good. So it turns out that phase transition. So each sort of Z2 gauge theory layer, I'll say it this way. Let's just talk about ordinary Z2 gauge theory. Ordinary Z2 gauge theory has essentially a version of Kramer's 1A duality, which relates it to the 2+1D Ising model. So those two are sort of Kramer's 1A dual to one another. And it turns out in this this decoupled layer model, you can apply Kramer's 1A duality kind of plane by plane in this construction. And in that way, you can relate the phase transition to a phase transition of another model. And it turns out that this other model that you get when you apply Kramer's 1A duality plane by plane is essentially 3+1D Z2 gauge theory. So somehow the statement is that the confinement deconfinement phase transition of 3+1D Z2 gauge theory, if you apply this sort of exotic Kramer's 1A duality where you apply it plane by plane, gets mapped precisely to this transition between decoupled toric code layers and the X-cube model. In a sense, you can get your hands on the critical theory. It's sort of dual to this other critical theory that I guess we know, but is, of course, is very complicated. Does that answer make sense?
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Okay, so in my remaining 8 minutes, I sort of just want to, these couple layer constructions that I've been describing so far to a high energy theorist kind of have the smell of brains and string theory. And so in my remaining time, I want to kind of try to make precise, or at least give some intuition for some kind of analogy between brain physics and these couple layer constructions. And so, well, first, like, why should one want such a connection at all? And well, the answer is essentially historical precedence. You know, string theory has been historically very useful for gaining insight into quantum field theories. And the basic way that this happens is that, you know, in certain limits, the physics of a web of brains is described by a quantum field theory that lives on its world volume. And so somehow, you know, if you're interested in studying some kind of field theory and you manage to embed it into string theory as the world volume theory of a web of brains, then you can often kind of leverage the rich structure of string theory to reason about the physics of the field theory. And one very beautiful example of this this principle in action is work of Hanani and Winton, in which they showed that S duality of type 2B string theory essentially implies infinite families of sort of supersymmetric versions of particle vortex dualities in 2 plus 1D. And they managed to do this by studying, you know, webs of D3 brains and D5 brains and NS5 brains. So in order to try to make this analogy precise, I'm going to rely on this this notion of a foliated field theory that's been developed by these authors. And okay, the rough intuition is just that the foliated field theory is sort of a kind of field theory that you obtain by taking a continuum limit of some of the coupled wire and coupled layer constructions I've been describing so far. And so maybe the sort of simplest example of a theory that you can cook up in this way is, you know, you imagine foliating 2 plus 1D space with 1 plus 1D free compact boson wires along the rows and columns of the plane. And in the continuum limit, you essentially get a Lagrangian like this without the A's. That on its own is sort of boring because it's just a bunch of decoupled free theories, but you can make the theory a little more interesting by coupling it to a bulk 2 plus 1D electromagnetism, for example. So if you'd like, this is sort of very much in the spirit of the constructions I've described so far, because you should think that this bulk electromagnetism is imposing some kind of relation between the symmetries on the different wires. Essentially, what it's saying is that, you know, in this gauged theory, doing a phase rotation on all the columns is sort of equivalent to doing the opposite phase rotation on all the rows, essentially. Okay, and so I claim that precisely that structure, well, supersymmetric and complicated version of it arises in the physics of D2 brains and D4 brains. And so what's the basic idea? The basic idea is that, you know, you can study the sort of brain configuration where you have a D2 brain in the bulk wrapping, you know, the T, X, and Y directions. And then you have D4 brains, which in the XY plane intersect this D2 brain along wires. And somehow the field content of the theory that's describing strings stretching from the D2 brain to the D2 brain is captured by a 2 plus 1D gauge field plus its super partners. And strings which stretch from the D2 brain to each D4 brain sort of contribute a hypermultiplet, which consists of two oppositely charged complex scalars plus their super partners. And this hypermultiplet is sort of localized along this intersection, which is precisely this wire. So you should think that in the continuum limit, it essentially goes over to the model I wrote down before, but suitably supersymmetrized. The reason that this model has a subsystem symmetry is because each D4 brain in principle should have a U1 gauge field on its world volume. But in the sort of standard decoupling limits that one has to take, if one wants to keep the gauge coupling constant on the D2 brain finite, then it turns out more or less by dimensional analysis, the gauge coupling constant on the D4 brains has to go to zero. And so when that happens in this limit, what used to be the gauge symmetry on the world volume of the D4 brains looks like a global symmetry from the perspective of the physics on the D2s. And so somehow you should think you're getting a U1 global symmetry for each of these D4 brains, which is foliating space. And so, you know, in the continuum limit, it goes over to something that looks like a subsystem symmetry. And I'll just comment that by you know, going up one dimension and going into type 2B and using D3 brains and D5 brains, that puts you sort of in the realm of Hanani-Witten type brain setups. And a particular one thing you can use to your advantage to study these brain setups is S-duality of type 2B string theory. So if you have a sort of D3, D5 system where you foliate 3 plus 1D space by D5 planes, that's basically the same construction that I just told you, but in one dimension higher. But now S-duality exchanges it for an equivalent description, which essentially becomes like this very long circular quiver gauge theory, where you have sort of L U1 gauge fields. L is maybe like the number of links here. And you have bifundamentals corresponding to strings stretching sort of across these NS5 brains. So somehow taking the continuum limit of both sides leads to like kind of interesting dualities of foliated field theories, which I have not written down for you because they're a little bit complicated to write down, and maybe it's better to just tell you it in words. One last construction I'll summarize before concluding, which one might like more because it's gapped and non-supersymmetric, is so it makes use of this construction due to these authors. So in this approach to fracton order, the authors essentially try to generalize the success of Chern-Simons theory in describing abelian topological order in 2 plus 1D. And so what they do is somehow they take a large L number of U1 gauge fields and they couple them together with a very large K matrix. And one sort of thinks of this index I that labels these L different U1 gauge fields as labeling different layers of a stack of 2 plus 1D theories. And in this picture, the non-zero off-diagonal elements of the K-matrix, which, you know, for locality's sake, you should take to be pretty close to being diagonal, those non-zero off-diagonal elements are interpreted as like couplings between the different layers. You can sort of pretty quickly see by messing around with taking determinants of like large matrices that are nearly diagonal, that this sort of reproduces one of the main features of fracton theories that I was harping on about, which is that they have ground state degeneracy, which grows exponentially with L. So here you need the fact that the dimension of the Hilbert space in these theories on the torus, let's say, is the determinant of K. Okay, and so I'll just say in words the sort of brain construction that achieves this theory. Essentially, it involves a web of D4 brains and NS5 brains. So in sort of the 4-6 plane, these NS5 brains form grids. This should be D4, not D5. Form a tiling, and you somehow string D4 brains in between these NS5 brains. And the arrows in this diagram correspond to sort of bifundamental matter in a quiver turn Simon's gauge theory. And somehow these, each of the tiles is a node of the quiver gauge theory. And the nice thing about this is that you can sort of completely gap out the system by sort of separating the brains from one another. When you separate brains from one another, strings have to stretch a non-zero distance to get from one to the other. And so those fields become massive, essentially by an amount that's proportional to the distance between the brains. And so it's well known that when you sort of integrate out charged chiral multiplets, you produce Chern-Simons terms. And so it turns out when you integrate out bifundamental chirals, then you produce off diagonal Chern-Simons terms. And so you can analyze, you know, a theory like this in the IR, and the K matrix that it gives rise to is this sort of nearly diagonal structure with couplings between between the different layers. Okay, so just to conclude, I've tried to tell you about how fractons sort of solve some interesting problems in quantum information theory, namely this problem of self-correcting quantum information storage. From the point of view of condensed matter physics, they form new stable phases of quantum lattice models. And I tried to give you some sense for how thinking about notions of higher form subsystem symmetries can help you organize some of these phases, and also understand some of these sort of coupled layer constructions. And I've tried to spell out an analogy which between fractons and brain physics, which we're only at the beginning stages of exploring, but I hope will lead to some cute physics. So with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Let's open for questions.
I can ask a question.
Uh-huh.
You said fractons solve the non-standing problem in error correction, but I may be wrong, but my impression is the protection of quantum memory in fractons only works at zero temperature, not at the finite temperature. Is it right?
No, I think it works at, it should work at finite temperature. It depends on which fracton model you're talking about. This XQ model is not good, I think, at finite temperature. But for example, this Haas cubic code that I told you about, I think its main claim to fame is that it actually does okay at finite temperature, like if you couple it to a heat bath. That was this model here.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
So what did we learn from string theory? I was a bit confused. So did we learn something new, or it's just a way of embedding a complicated theory into a more complicated one?
Yeah, so for now, I think we haven't learned too much new. Well, we got some dualities of some of these foliated constructions, which is sort of interesting. I think we're still sort of suitably at the beginning stages of exploring this, that we haven't fully justified why, you know, one should care about these brain constructions yet. But I'm hoping that'll be developed more in sort of some future work.
But what's the hope is that it will produce dualities between fractal models that will look very different, but in string theory, there is a clean explanation why they are the same. Is this?
Well, for me, the hope would be like, somehow like most of the field theories that people have written down that describe fracton models so far have been quadratic, have been free. So somehow we haven't had like very good handles on interacting theories with subsystem symmetries, for example. So maybe the hope for me would be that string theory would give us tools to analyze like interacting fracton models, for example. That would be like one hope. And you know, also maybe that it plays some kind of organizational role in helping us, like, you know, so somehow like maybe like, for example, in this Hanani-Witten work, you know, I think in principle, you probably could have derived all of these dualities purely, you know, using ideas of field theory, but somehow like string theory reduces it, it sort of compresses the information you need to keep track of. All you have to do is like draw pictures of brains and somehow like everything's right there. And so it helps you keep track of everything in your head. So hopefully like brains will serve a similar role in fractal theories.
Yeah, so you describe this foliated field theory is essentially in flat space, correct?
Yes.
Is it known what the geometry that you have to couple these two is?
Sorry, the geometry that you have to couple them?
Yeah. What is the geometrical structure that you would need to couple the system with these symmetries? What's the analog of going to curved backgrounds in this case? What is appropriate? You know, in some, there are some theories that are not relativistic that we know what that, you know, there's things like Newton-Cartan geometry or whatever. What's the analog of that here?
Okay, I think maybe what you're asking is like, yeah, how do you put fractals on curved space or something? Or
yeah, for example, or in your continuum language, what are the appropriate geometrical structures that you need?
Yeah, good. I'll say that the problem of putting fractals on general curved manifolds is like ongoing research, and I think it's not completely known how to do it. But in these particular foliated field theory constructions, so I focused on the situation in which the foliations are sort of by trivial, like flat leaves, so to speak. But actually these, and that's because, you know, in the brain picture, you sort of need to put them on flat leaves for stability of the brain system. But you know, these authors, they study these field theories coupled to more general what they call background foliation fields. And essentially what that's meant to describe is sort of like situations in which you're not just foliating space by these flat leaves, but rather by more general sort of maybe curved foliations and things like that. So that seems to be I guess you would think of it as a background field structure that you could couple these foliated field theories to. In terms of the actual like space time that they're defined on, introducing curvature to that, I'm afraid I don't know the state of the art there, but I think two papers appeared like recently, like within the past month or something like that. Did I answer your question, or?
I guess so, yeah.
So maybe I can ask a very naive question. So for me, this was fantastic because I know nothing about this subject, and this was a very nice review of the subject. But could you highlight a little bit, because as you say, in your conclusion, right, this general statement could be made in more or less any fractal talk. So for someone like me that is not an expert on fractals, could you tell me a little bit what were the results that you guys found that are related to this particular topic? I kind of missed in the last part, for example. I think in the part that Sung Sik was asking about, was more clear. But if you could just highlight a little bit what were the main results.
Sure. So this entire portion sort of from this slide onwards where I talked about brain constructions, I mean, you know, these versions of these brain constructions of course existed, but the analogy to fractals was not understood previously. So somehow like you should think that all these brain constructions and their analogies with fractal physics were part of our results. So I didn't get to fully explain everything that I wanted to explain in the CMT portion of the talk, but I think it's fair to say that this notion of a higher form subsystem symmetry we hadn't seen in the literature before, and so we sort of we tried to emphasize it and explore some of its conclusions. And in particular, one thing we looked at was we both like revisited some old known coupled layer constructions with these symmetry considerations in mind, and in particular, revisiting those old coupled layer constructions, thinking about symmetry, and it helped us like come up with new coupled layer constructions, and it sort of revealed the logic that underlies it. And so, yeah, I didn't quite get to tell you about some of the new constructions we had, but somehow, like, you know, all the ones involving the cubic icing model were not, to my knowledge, known before. So that was basically the contributions there. In the QI portion of the talk, I didn't have much at all to do with you know, this self-correcting quantum memory storage, but I tried to sneak in a small contribution that we made to error, to just ordinary error correction, which was to prove that these Kitaev models associated to arbitrary finite groups are quantum error correcting. So I think that's like the summary of.
Thanks a lot. Any other questions? Comments, skeptical remarks? If not, let's thank Brandon once more for a very nice talk and review.